We ended the sermon last Sabbath in with the worship, what is worship part one. We ended that sermon noting that post-resurrection of Jesus Christ, worship largely moved from some sort of temple, physical structure or territory to the individual that God was calling. Those individuals collectively made up the greater spiritual temple of God. But we see this sort of move in that direction. The book of Hebrews largely talks about that. Let's begin over in the book of 1 Corinthians. If you'll go with me there. 1 Corinthians chapter 3. And we'll see this move, this transition in a very powerful way. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 16. In the New King James Version, it says, "Do you not know that you are the temple of God, and the Spirit of God dwells in you? If anyone defiles the temple of God, God will destroy him, for the temple of God is holy, which temple you are." Throughout Paul's writings, he moves various sacred concepts from a physical structure to the individual believer's relationship with God. And while our calling is no doubt individual, we do come together and we do worship collectively. The New King James in this verse, these two verses, verses 16 and 17, can be challenging. Right? When we use the word "you" in our modern English, it kind of carries two different connotations. Right? I can ask you to please take a drink of water, right? Or I could ask all of you to stand up and let's sing a hymn, right? We use the word "you" both singular and in a plural context, and we sort of have to look at that sentence to identify whether we're talking to one specific individual or to a group. And so when we look at a verse like 1 Corinthians 3, verses 16 and 17, we have several "yous" here. But what's curious about this verse is some of these are plural and some are singular. The Old King James Version, if you have that translation on your laps, renders this verse very well. Even though it's the Old English with the "these" and "thous" and "thuses" and "hithers" and all of that, it uses the "ye" and "you." So "ye" in Old English would be the collective group form of the word, and "you" being the singular. Now, this is how the Old King James renders 1 Corinthians 3, verses 16 and 17. And you can follow along in whatever translation you have. The Old King James says, "Know ye not that ye are the temple of God," right, collectively speaking, "and that the Spirit of God dwells in you," singular. "If any man defile the temple of God, him shall God destroy, for the temple of God is holy, which temple ye are." Even going further up the text here to verse 9, we see Paul talking about how the congregation has become that building. The congregation has become that temple. Within the old covenant structure, the temple was indeed holy. The priest rendered sacred service. Worship, though, was centered around that physical sanctuary. Coming into the New Testament, as Jesus Christ would point to, and as Paul and other New Testament writers would write about, the believer now is part of God's temple. That temple is made up of God's people. The believer renders sacred service in that temple. And worship is now centered around a relationship with God through His Spirit. All of this, of course, does not eliminate assemblies, does not eliminate Sabbaths, it does not eliminate holy convocations. It simply means that that word that we looked at last Sabbath, latreo, is no longer restricted to only those group occasions. In fact, if the believer is God's temple 24 hours a day, then sacred service can be rendered 24 hours a day. If we take this, and by extension where we left last Sabbath in part one, if we leave that, let's continue to build on it. If you'll turn with me to John chapter 4, and like the last sermon, we'll be coming back here often to John 4. So feel free to move last week's ribbon from Matthew 4. Feel free to move it here to John 4. Put some sort of marker. We'll leave and come back a few different times during the sermon. John chapter 4 begins with this encounter and conversation that Jesus Christ ends up having with a Samaritan woman. And we kind of break into the story flow here. You can read the context a little bit later, but we'll kind of break into this story flow here. In verse 21, she's making comments about the mountain and Jerusalem and these established physical places of worship. And in verse 21, Jesus responds to her. He says, "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when you will neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We know what we worship, for salvation is of the Jews. But the hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth." Each of these words throughout this passage, these several verses here, is a word that we looked at in the last sermon. It's proskuneo. But notice that Jesus himself says that worship would move to the individual's part of the temple, and that it would be done in spirit and truth. And those are very important components. Not just spirit, not just truth, but the combination. Not at a physical location, not in that mountain at the time, not in Jerusalem, not at a temple, not at a building, not in some defined territory, but individually, Christ says, through God's Spirit and with God's truth. So in the sermon today, I'd like to move inward a bit. I'd like to move inward inside us. To properly worship God, today we move inward to our heart and to our core. Let's go back to Matthew, the book of Matthew, and turn with me, if you will, to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15. We'll come back and look at the context here in just a few minutes, but at the end of this rebuttal that Jesus Christ is pushing back on against this question that the scribes and Pharisees had, he ends his answer by quoting a passage in Isaiah. And we'll just jump right to the very end of his response. Matthew chapter 15 and verse 9, quoting Isaiah, he says, "And in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men." In the last sermon, we spent considerable time in Matthew chapter 4 in verses 8, 9, and 10 in that third temptation that Satan offers to Jesus. Satan himself sought proskuneo, right? That homage, that bowing down, that recognition of him being the authority in Jesus' life. Jesus rebuffs that and adds to it latreo, that component of sacred service to God. But here we see Jesus not using either one of those words, but a different word. Jesus is not discussing bowing. He's not discussing some sort of recognition of a supreme authority or sacred service. Instead, Jesus Christ here, quoting Isaiah, is talking about one's religious reverence and whether that religious reverence is grounded in God's truth or if it's grounded in human tradition. The scribes and Pharisees, we know, were incredibly religiously devoted. Right? They had high regard for their religious reverence. They were extremely reverent. But the point here that Jesus makes by quoting Isaiah is that the object of their devotion and the object of their reverence was placed in themselves. It was placed in themselves, not in the true God. The word that's translated for worship here in verse 9 is sabumai. I'll spell it just like I did last week, and then I'll make reference through it, and you can figure out your notation in your notes. Sabumai, S-E-B-O-M-A-I. Sabumai, S-E-B-O-M-A-I. Sabumai. It simply means reverence, religious regard or inward devotion. And this is the word that Jesus Christ uses to respond back to the scribes and Pharisees. If we pop back up to the beginning of the chapter, we see the scribes and Pharisees who are from Jerusalem came to Jesus and posed this question. Verse 2, why do your disciples transgress the tradition of the elders? You would think that their own question should have been their own red flag, right? Why are your people not doing what we think they should? They're transgressing our traditions, right? They're not upset with Jesus because his disciples were going against a law back in the Old Testament, back in the Torah. They weren't upset with them because they felt that his disciples were breaking one of the Ten Commandments. They were upset with Jesus because his disciples, according to them, transgressed human tradition. And that's what they were upset with. At the end of Jesus Christ's lengthy reply here, he quotes Isaiah 29, verse 13, and he says that their sabumai is in vain. It's in vain. That Greek word means fruitless or futile. It can mean false or invalid. It's a powerful statement that Jesus Christ is making. It's not just that you're sort of in the mud spinning your wheels, right? He's saying that their sabumai, their reverence, their religious devotion is completely misplaced. It's false. It's invalid. The issue was that their heart's religious regard was not toward God. They had a heart problem. The scribes and Pharisees had a heart problem. They had religious regard, but it wasn't for God. Their religious regard was found back up in verse 2, their own human tradition. Their teachings of religious devotion was corrupted. Christ says it was fruitless, it was futile, it was invalid. There's only 10 uses of this Greek word sabumai in the New Testament. Let's look at a couple other examples to kind of help complete this word picture of what this of how this word is used. Let's turn to the book of Acts, Acts chapter 16. Acts chapter 16, and let's notice verse 14. Acts chapter 16, verse 14. Now a certain woman named Lydia heard us. She was a seller of purple from the city of Thyatira, who sabumai, God. She worshipped God. Sabumai. She had a religious regard, a religious devotion to God. The Lord opened her heart to heed the things spoken by Paul. When she and her house were baptized, she begged us, saying, if you have judged me to be faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay. So she persuaded us. Lydia here is described as a God-fearer, a God-fearer. She had this religious regard for God, and she was ready to hear what Paul had to say, and she was ready to put that into practice. But she's described here as sabumai. Drop down to chapter 17. Chapter 17, verse 1, they come to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. Then Paul, as his custom was, went into them and for three Sabbaths reasoned with them from the Scriptures, explaining and demonstrating that Christ had to suffer and rise again from the dead, and saying, "This Jesus whom I preach to you is the Christ." And some of them were persuaded, and a great number of the Sabumai, Greeks, it's translated devout here, devout, Sabumai, Greeks, and not a few of the leading women joined Paul and Silas. The emphasis here is on religious reverence. And this is how Luke, who's the author of the book of Acts, chooses to describe these people. They had a religious reverence toward this message. And so Luke describes them as Sabumai. These Greeks were described like this, and some of the other brethren that's mentioned here, some of the leading women. Next chapter, chapter 18. Paul here preaching in Macedonia. He ends up departing from there. Acts chapter 18 and verse 7. He departed from there and entered the house of a certain man named Justus, one who worshipped God, Sabumai, whose house was next door to the synagogue. Then Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed on the Lord with all his household, and many of the Corinthians, hearing, believed and were baptized. Again, Justus here is described as someone who Sabumai God. He had this deep internal reverence for God. This personal reverence, this religious reverence toward God. Let's look at one more example. Acts chapter 19, the next chapter. Acts 19 and verse 27. Here we see a positive impact on one hand, but if you are in the industry where you make idols, then Paul's message is causing some challenges in your income stream. And some of these workers, some of these craftsmen came and approached God's people, approached Paul and said, "Hey, what you're teaching is causing people to leave idolatry and they're no longer buying our idols." Breaking into their comment here in verse 27. "So not only is this trade of ours in danger of falling into disrepute, but also the temple of the great goddess Diana may be despised and her magnificence destroyed, whom all Asia and the world, Sabumai." All of Asia and indeed the world worships Diana and the idolatry that came with that idol worship. The city of Ephesus here renders religious reverence toward Diana. The object is false, but the nature of the devotion is the same. There is great internal devotion to this false idol. And so Luke uses this word, Sabumai. Sabumai may be the most internal form of worship that we've talked about so far. In the last sermon, we talked about prosteneo, often manifests in a physical way with words. There's this acknowledgement that there's a supreme authority. Right? And as a result, then there's a humble submission to that authority. Latreo manifests itself through sacred service. Sabumai, here as we have seen, appears to be within the heart. It's the heart's reverence. It's the amount of reverence and esteem that one has for the true God, or in some cases, like Ephesus here, a false god, an idol. I mentioned that there's only 10 uses of Sabumai in the New Testament. 8 of them are written by Luke. They're used by Luke. He tends to use it to identify people before telling us what they do. It often functions almost like a descriptor of of who they are religiously, what kind of person they are. He described Lydia as a Sabumai woman. The devout Greeks, he labeled and defined them, described them as Sabumai people. Justice was a Sabumai man. We see this form of worship as describing the attitude of reverence. And that attitude of reverence then allows us to see some of the expressions of worship that flow from that. Let's go back to Matthew. Matthew chapter 15. We have this statement again that Jesus Christ uses from Isaiah against the scribes and Pharisees. Matthew chapter 15 and verse 9. A person can physically bow. They can even acknowledge that there is this authority. Prosterneo, like we talked last time. But someone can bow, someone can recognize authority, and they can still not have genuine reverence. Sabumai. Right? You can bow, you can acknowledge an authority, and you can submit yourself to that, maybe because you feel you have to, but you can still do that without having genuine reverence, sabumai. A person can also perform some form of sacred service, latreo, like we talked last time, and that can even be done without sabumai, without this deep reverence, right? You're almost going through the motions, right? You're offering the service, but it's not really what's inside. It's not really part of you. You really don't have that genuine reverence, that sabumai. And Matthew 15, verse 9 here demonstrates that exactly. Jesus Christ says, you have all of this before you, and yet you don't revere. You don't have this deep reverence for who and what God is. In vain, he says, they sabumai me. The problem was not lack of religious activity. Like they had the ceremonies, they had the traditions, they had the teachings, they had the observances, they had all of that. What was missing was the proper heart. What was missing was the orientation toward the one true God. The issue is directing reverence toward the right object according to truth. And so in Acts 19, we see the Ephesians sabumai, the idol Diana. They had religious reverence, but the object was wrong. The Gentiles could be described as sabumai. The scribes and Pharisees could sabumai God, but in vain, as verse 9 points out. So Matthew 15, verse 9 here is very important in our understanding of what true worship is. Here's the key. Here's a key. Reverence by itself is not sufficient. Right? Reverence by itself is not sufficient. In fact, as we've seen through several examples, reverence can even be very grossly misplaced. So let's pause here just for a second. Let's pause. Let's catch our breath. Let's ask a series of questions before we move on. It's important that we ask a series of questions. We have prosterneo that we talked about in the last sermon. Homage, submission to authority, acknowledgement of that supreme authority. With prosterneo, we should be asking, who is my God? Who is my God? Sabumai that we're learning about here today, religious reverence, esteem, internal devotion. With sabumai, we ask, what is it that I hold sacred? What do I hold sacred? And then the other word from last Sabbath, latreo, that sacred service, that devotion that's rendered, hopefully, to God. We ask, to whom is my devotion directed? So who is my God? Prosterneo. Sabumai, what do I hold sacred? And then the other word from last Sabbath, latreo, To whom is that devotion directed? To whom is it directed? Now let's notice what happens. If we get the answer to the first question wrong, the first question being prosterneo, who is my God? If we answer that question wrong, if it's incorrect, then everything below it becomes corrupted. Everything below it becomes corrupted. If we don't answer correctly, who is my God? Then what I hold sacred and who is my devotion directed to automatically are wrong, right? They're automatically corrupted. A person can revere very deeply. Sabu Mai. A person can have deep reverence, deep religious reverence. Sabu Mai. They can devote their entire life in service. Latreo. They can even sacrifice and serve their fellow brothers and sisters. Yet all of it can be directed toward the wrong authority. That's essentially the tragedy of idolatry, isn't it? Let's go back to John chapter 4. Back to where your ribbon is, perhaps, or your marker. John chapter 4. And in this section of scripture that we're using sort of as our baseline here today, we see this statement from Jesus Christ. The hour is coming when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. Right, verse 23. And then he echoes the same statement in verse 24. Those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. These worships, though, as I pointed out before, this is prosterneo. This is that acknowledgement of a supreme authority, willingly and humbly submitting yourself to that. It's paying the homage. Again, it can and often in times includes sort of a lowering down of oneself, kneeling. We showed an example last week of feet being held tightly. Right? There's a bowing, there's a kneeling, there's a falling down. Oftentimes it's met with this sort of physical expression. Jesus Christ uses prosterneo, though, here in John 4. Maybe this is the reason. Perhaps this is the reason why Jesus Christ uses prosterneo. Because, again, if we miss that first question, who is my God, then everything else becomes corrupted. Jesus starts with the question of who do we worship? Who is our worship directed toward? He starts with that. He doesn't start here in verses 23 and 24. He doesn't start by talking about feelings, about how what services are being rendered, about rituals, how good a person might be with singing or with instruments or any other qualifier. Jesus Christ doesn't start there. He starts with prosterneo, that acknowledgement of God as our authority. The Father is first established as the rightful object of our worship. Then comes in spirit and truth. Recognition and acceptance of God's authority appears to be the foundational aspect of worship. It's foundational. Without that, reverence can become misplaced. Sabu Mai can be misplaced. Devotion, latreo, can become misdirected. Right? If we miss that first question, who is my God? Then everything that follows can and usually is corrupted. We spent a lot of time last sermon in Matthew 4:10. I won't ask you to turn back there. That's that section with the third temptation from Satan toward Jesus. But even then, if you recall those verses, Jesus establishes the proper order, right? You worship God, you prosterneo God, then you add to it sacred service, you latreo, right? He established that even in the temptation that Satan gave to him. Everything else flows then from that first acknowledgement of who the true God is, who the object of our worship is. Okay, outside of a few Old Testament references, we haven't been to the Old Testament yet. Some of you pointed that out last Sabbath. Let's go to the Old Testament. Let's specifically go to Exodus chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32, if you're familiar with your rough passages of the book of Exodus, ancient Israel has already come out of Egypt. They've already crossed the Red Sea. They're in the area there of Mount Sinai. Moses is receiving instructions from God, commandments from God. We're toward the end of that time period. So let's pick it up. Verse 32, verse 1 here tells us a little bit of that background. Exodus 32, verse 1. And when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us gods that shall go before us. For this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And Aaron said to them, verse 2, "Break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me." So all the people broke off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them to Aaron. Remember, the key here is that authority precedes all other forms of worship. Recognizing that authority precedes all other forms of worship. Keep that in mind. Let's read verse 4. "And he, Aaron, received the gold from their hand, and he fashioned it with an engraving tool and made a molded calf. Then they said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.'" This is your God. This is the supreme authority in your life. This is the one that saved you, that brought you from the land, that did all those magnificent things. This is your God, right? This is the God that saved you. It's interesting that at the end of verse 4, they don't begin with, "Okay, let's revere this image. Let's revere this calf." They don't start there. "Let's serve this calf. Let's create some rituals for this calf. Let's bow down to this calf." It's not where they start. The end of verse 4, then they say, "This is your God that brought you out of the land of Egypt." It begins with an identity claim. This is the one that saved you. This is the one responsible for your deliverance. This is the power that brought you out. This is your God. In other words, this is your authority. This is your authority. I find it strikingly similar to Satan's temptation that we read last Sabbath in Matthew chapter 4. Satan was not merely seeking a physical bow. He wasn't just seeking sacred service or some level of reverence. He was seeking recognition as the rightful ruler. The golden calf here is not being presented as some beautiful piece of artwork. Hey, we're bored. Give me all your gold and we'll make something pretty out of gold. It's not being presented as a decorative piece of art. It was being presented as the source of Israel's salvation and therefore worthy of their allegiance. And only after that authority-based recognition is made, then we see other worship-related behaviors. Verse 5, "Tomorrow is a feast to the Lord." Verse 6, "Then they offered sacrifices. Then they ate and drank. Then they rose up to play." Right? All those other forms of worship, all those other expressions followed once the authority was established. This is your God. The religious activity flowed from their prior acceptance of the authority. It was a false authority, but nonetheless, they accepted the authority. Let's go one layer deeper. Let's go back a number of days. back to Exodus chapter 20. They've arrived to Mount Sinai. God delivers the Ten Commandments. And we have them listed here in Exodus chapter 20. They're repeated in Deuteronomy 5, but to stay here in Exodus, we'll read the record here in Exodus chapter 20. Our local Sabbath school program just finished going through these Ten Commandments and talking about them. God said, verse 1, he spoke all these words saying, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. It's interesting that, 13 chapters later, Israel forgets this. Right, here's your golden calf. This is who brought you out of Egypt. But notice verse 3, the first commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. Have you ever wondered why that's the first commandment? Why is that the first commandment? The second commandment is in verse 4. You shall not make for yourself a carved image. Right? It goes on with some more details. Why is the carved image not the first commandment? Why is have no other gods? Why is that not the second commandment or even the third commandment? Why is the first commandment the first commandment? You ever thought about that? I find it interesting that even in context of what we're describing here with worship, acknowledging God as our God, acknowledging God as our source, our authority, the one that we submit ourselves to, the one that we bow down to, that we give homage to, that seems to be the foundation of worship. And maybe that gives a little hint into why the first commandment is the first commandment. Acknowledge God's authority first. Have no other authority besides him. Bow down to no other gods but him. Submit yourself only to God. No other God. Again, that first question, who is your God? Who is your authority? And then the second command, once you establish who your God is, then the second command, don't express your devotion by way of any created image, any carved image. And this brings us back to John 4. Let's go back to the New Testament, to John chapter 4. Again, back to our verses here in verse 23 and 24 of John chapter 4. The hour is coming when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. It's interesting to me that Jesus does not say true worshipers will show reverence. True worshipers will perform sacred service. Instead, he specifically uses prosteneo. True worshipers will prosteneo the Father. They will acknowledge him as their God. Who is your God? God is my God. The one true God is my God. The object of the worship is correctly identified first. Then we're able to worship God in spirit and truth. Once we establish that authority and who our God is, then we can successfully and beneficially worship God in spirit and truth. So again, prosteneo, who is your God? That's the first question. And if we get that question wrong, if we answer that question incorrectly, then every other form of worship becomes corrupted, no matter how sincere it may be. We get that question wrong, and every other form of worship becomes corrupted, even if it's done in a very sincere and authentic way. It's corrupted because we've missed the foundation. That's essentially the lesson from both the golden calf in Exodus 32 and Jesus' temptation there in Matthew chapter 4. Okay, let's add a little bit more to this. Let's add a little bit more. The next word that I want to look at is thrusteia. Thrusteia. I'll spell it for you again, just like before. You can figure out your notation in your notes. Thrusteia, T-H-R-E, T-H-R-E-S-K-E-I-A. Thrusteia, T-H-R-E-S-K-E-I-A, Thrusteia. This simply means a religious practice, observance. It can mean the religion itself, that the religious system itself. Let's look at a couple examples here as we add this word into the mix. Let's go back to Acts chapter 26. Acts chapter 26. The Apostle Paul here is nearing the end of his life within the next couple years, and he's in this process of being elevated to various higher authorities within the Roman government on his way for his appeal to the Caesar. And in Acts chapter 26, we see him having a conversation with King Agrippa. Acts chapter 26, and in verse 3, he begins to relate some of his history to King Agrippa. And we'll just kind of break into his dialogue back to King Agrippa. In verse 5, Paul, speaking of the Jews, the Pharisees specifically, he says in Acts chapter 26, verse 5, "They knew me from the first. If they were willing to testify that according to the strictest sect of our Thrusteia, I lived a Pharisee." And so we have this religious system, and Paul refers to that religious system. "I've been a part of that system. I know that system. That is my religion." Right? That's what my religion looks like, is this sect of the Pharisees. I was part of that system. Thrusteia. Paul's talking about the religious system or his religious practice within that Pharisaical sect. Let's look at another example. Colossians chapter 2. Colossians chapter 2, Paul starts out battling various local heresies that are going on at the time here in the church at Colossae. In verse 18 of chapter 2, Paul says, "Let no one cheat you of your reward, taking delight in false humility and thrusteia of angels," worship of angels, thrusteia of angels, "intruding into those things which he has not seen, vainly puffed up by his fleshly mind." Paul here is not talking about bowing down before angels. He's not talking about showing some level of sacred service to the angels. He's discussing a religious system, a religious practice centered around angels. And what he's describing here is a religious system of putting angels at the middle of that worship. Let's look at one more example. James, the book of James. I'll drop a teaser here for part 3. Many of us really love the book of James. And if I were to poll the congregation, how many's favorite book is the book of James? I would suspect there's a decent number of hands that would go up. And by the time we get to the end of part 3, you may have a new appreciation for the book of James. I'll just leave that dangle there for you. James, we're here in James chapter 1. Let's notice verse 26. "If anyone among you thinks he is thrusteia, and does not bridle his tongue, but deceives his own heart, that one's thrusteia is useless." James doesn't say, if anyone thinks he worships, then your sacred service is what we need to look at. If anyone thinks he's religious, if anyone thinks he has, you know, this religious system, this religious mindset sort of all sewn up, then you're good to go, right? As long as you think it, as long as you're attached to the right church, as long as you're attached to the right identity, as long as you go and worship at the right address. That's not what James is saying. He goes on. James places the emphasis on the outward religious expression. So if anyone thinks they're religious, verse 26, and does not bridle his tongue, then it's useless. He addresses his own comment, right? Do you think that your religion is with purpose? Do you think your religious system is correct? But you're not willing to bridle your tongue, then James says, "Pah, well, you're a hypocrite then. Hold your tongue," he says. In verse 27, he goes on, "Pure and undefiled thrusteia before God and the Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unspotted from the world." It's curious here that James has not defined religion as bowing or service or singing hymns or playing instruments or dancing or going to church or even sacrificing. He describes the visible expression of a person's faith. What should my religion look like? What should my faith look like? And James answers that question. Hold my tongue. Take care of the fatherless. Look after the widows. Keep unspotted from the world. He gives us four examples of what it should look like. When we consider this word thrusteia, we can ask another question. How is that person's religion expressed? How is that person's religion expressed? Or to ask it a different way, what does your religion look like in your life? What does your religion look like in your life? James here tells us, it should look like this. It should look like someone who has control of their words, who looks after these various groups within the congregation, who remains unspotted from the world. Okay, we've come to the part of the sermon where maybe some of these are starting to bleed together a little bit. We have thrusteia, we have sabumai. And maybe those words are starting to blend a little bit. Maybe they're starting to blur a little. Sabumai is that religious reverence. Thrusteia is the religious expression. It's what it looks like. When we read the sabumai verses, it describes a person's perspective toward God. Lydia, we read, was a woman who worshiped God. She had a positive relationship. She had a positive outlook. She had a positive direction toward God. There were devout Greeks, devout women. On the negative side, we have the Ephesians who sabumied the temple of Diana. But there's this religious expression, this religious reverence, that was important to them. And they're described according to those terms. Luke is the one that by far uses that word. And Luke seems to be describing these individuals by saying, what kind of people are they? What kind of people are they? We describe people like that all the time, don't we? Oh, I'm looking for the guy that's about this high. I'm looking for the person that's this high, or I'm looking for the person wearing that colored outfit today. We use words to describe people. Oh, it's the guy with the hair like this, or it's the guy with limited hair, or it's the guy or the woman, we use expressions to describe people. And this is how Luke describes people, uses sabumai. They were God-revering people, or they were religiously devoted people. Luke uses those concepts to describe people. And in the case of the Ephesians, even in a negative way. They had great reverence, but it was toward an idol. Then we come here to James. And James does something very different. If Sabu Mai asks, what kind of person are you? Then Thrasteia asks, what does your religion produce? Right? Sabu Mai might ask, what kind of person are you? But Thrasteia goes deeper. Thrasteia asks, what does your religion produce? We can say it a different way. Maybe I'll offer several angles here, and maybe something will resonate. Sabu Mai asks, what resides in my heart? Thrasteia asks, what can others observe in my life? What can others observe in my life? Luke was not telling us what Lydia was doing. Luke wasn't telling us what the Ephesians were doing or the Greeks were doing. He told us what kind of person they were, what was residing in their heart. They were Sabu Mai people. They were a reverent people. Luke is describing their character. He's describing their religious orientation, you might say. Some examples that we could even use. We might say, oh, that's a virtuous woman. Or that's a God-fearing man. Or that's a religiously minded person. Right? We use these expressions sometimes. Oh, that's a righteous man. This is all Luke is doing with this Greek word, Sabu Mai. He's describing them. He's describing this reverence that they have. James does something a little bit different. James tells us what a person does. Luke tells us what the person is through Sabu Mai. James tells us what a person does. This person visits the widows. This person looks after the fatherless. This person remains unspotted from the world. This person has control of their tongue. That's Thrasteia. James is not interested in labels. And in fact, throughout the book of James, he often pushes back on labels and titles. Oh, you think you're religious? Well, let's see. You think you're religious, right? Yeah? Okay, well, let's see. James takes the title and says, okay, maybe, but let's see what that title says about you. Let's see what that badge says about you. And in following verses then, he uses this mirror example. We'll get to that here in a couple minutes. If we further refine this, labels like internal and external seem to fall short. Maybe we could come at this another angle. We could ask, well, what's their focus? These two Greek words, what's their focus? Sabu Mai describes the object of the person's reverence. Thrasteia describes the practice coming out of that person's reverence. A person, as we've seen, can Sabu Mai God or Diana or an angel or a series of idols. The question would be, what do I revere? What do I revere? A person may also Thrasteia. They may be pure. They may be defiled. They may be Pharisaical. They may be angel-centered. The question here would be, what religious system or practice comes from that reverence? Here in James chapter 1, notice verse 22. But be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in the mirror. For he observes himself, goes away, and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it, and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. It's relatively easy for us to claim religion. We have a world filled with people that claim religion. I'm this, I'm that, I'm part of this church, I'm over here. And as a result, they tend to worship all things spiritual. I am religious. James says, maybe, but let's test it. Let's test it. And the test, as James points out, is not church attendance. It's not a structure or a building. It's not rituals. It's not music. It's not ceremonies or declarations. It's not titles. James here in chapter 1 says the test is actually your speech, your conduct, your purity, your compassion. The test is whether you're a doer of the spiritual work that God started in each of us. Luke often uses sabu mai to describe the badge. The badge says who I am. James takes the badge off the shirt and says, well, let's examine the person wearing it. Let's go back to Acts again. We've already read the story of Lydia here, but let's read it once more, perhaps through this new lens. Acts chapter 16. And again, beginning in verse 14. Now, a certain woman named Lydia heard us. She was a seller of purple from the city of Thyatira who worshiped God. She was a sabu mai woman. So she has this badge, if you want to say it that way. She has this reverence. But notice what happens. So we continue verse 14. The Lord opened her heart to heed the things spoken by Paul. And when she and her household were baptized, she begged us, saying, if you have judged me to be so faithful to the Lord, come to my house and stay. So she persuaded us. Notice what happened there. She listened. God opened her heart to hear what Paul had to say. She responds. She changes. She repents. She's baptized. She supports the brethren. Her actions, the thrusteia, validated the badge, the sabu mai. Right, there was a validation. Acts chapter 17, we won't go through that example as well, but you can see something similar. There was this title, this badge, this acknowledgement. And then there was the thrusteia. Ah, well, this is what they do. And what they do matches the badge. And it matches the being that they've submitted themselves to. It goes back to the foundation and it all reconciles. With the devout Greeks, what were their actions? They responded to the gospel message. They pointed their life toward God. In conclusion, let's go back one more time to John chapter 4. John chapter 4. Jesus, as we've pointed out here, uses the word prosterneo, right? Acknowledge the supreme authority in your life. Humbly submit yourself to that authority. Pay homage to it. Jesus uses prosterneo here. Verse 23 again, true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. And again, verse 24 reiterates that once more. The Father here is first established as the rightful object. That's the one that we should give our authority. He's the one that we should submit our authority to, that we should submit ourselves to. Then comes in spirit and truth. Recognition and acceptance of God's authority does appear to be the foundation of worship. From there, who we are, sabu mai, flows from that foundation. And thrusteia then becomes the man in the mirror. Right? When we stand up and we look into that mirror, We claim to be a religious people. We claim to be God-fearing men and women. We claim to put our trust in God. We make lots of claims about our religion. But then Thrustea comes along and we look at ourselves in the mirror. We do that introspection. Remember our series of questions. Prosterneo, that homage, the submission to authority, the acknowledgement to the authority. Who is my God? Who is my God? Sabu Mai, that religious reverence, the esteem. We asked ourselves, what kind of person am I becoming? Latreo, the sacred service that we talked about last time, that devotion that's rendered to God. We asked, to whom is that devotion directed? And then the last word here, Thrustea, that's our demonstrated religion. That's what it looks like on the outside. What does my faith produce is our question. What does my faith produce? The first question is the foundational, and it sets the stage for what worship looks like and whether it's authentic, true worship or whether all of those other expressions are pointed in the wrong direction. In the next sermon, likely the final in the series, we're going to build one more layer. There's still one more layer to be built. And I hope to introduce what I think is a very powerful visual to help sort of put all of this into one neat package. It'll tie everything together. And we'll, at that point, then have the full picture of what it means to truly worship God. Until next time, let's take this next week and consider what kind of person we are. We all have this identity. I'm a child of God. I'm this kind of person. This is who I am religiously. Consider how it is that you would describe yourself. And then take that examination one layer deeper. Look in the mirror and see if that religion, see if your religion actually reflects what God has called each of us to become. So as we worship God this next week, enjoy the homework. Enjoy the time and that introspection, not just with this identity that we all want to have, but doing the examination to make sure that there's a match.